This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A little bit later in the hour, we'll talk with Richard Preston and talk about his new book, Panic in Level 4. But first, remember that old commercial for E.F. Hutton, where when E.F. Hutton talks, people listen? Well, the same thing could be said for my guest. When Ray Kurzweil makes a prediction about how life expectancy will increase faster than we age because of advances in genomics and nanotechnology, or how solar power is approaching the point where it will be able to compete with now cheaper fossil fuels, lots of folks listen. And that's because time and again, Ray Kurzweil has been right on the mark. And when he talks about how, not too far in the future, we humans will be better, smarter, and faster with the help of computers that will eventually merge with the machines we've made, people pay attention, even if his ideas sound more like science fiction than science. Well, Ray Kurzweil joins us now, fresh off his appearance at last week's World Science Festival here in New York, to talk about his view of the future and why we need to break out of the habit of linear thinking. He is an inventor, futurist, and author of The Singularity is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology. He's also the CEO of Kurzweil Technologies outside of Boston, and he joins us from WBUR in Boston. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Great to be with you, Ira, again, at least virtually.
How come you're right so many times?
Well, it turns out some things are actually quite predictable, despite the vagaries of history. If you look at the price performance of computing, for example, it forms a smooth doubly exponential curve going back to the 1890 census, which is surprising given how much apparently unexpected history we had in the 20th century. Mm-hmm. But we see other phenomena in science that's where you can get predictable results when every element in a complex system is unpredictable, like thermodynamics predicts mm-hmm. the properties of a gas, even though each particle follows a random walk. And technology development, particularly if you can measure the underlying information content of a process, follows these very smooth, predictable progressions like mm-hmm. genetic sequencing or brain data, all of these things, telecommunications, bits moved around on the internet. You plot them over many years, and they're very predictable, and they're exponential, as you pointed out.
Do you have a prediction that's ripe for coming true soon?
Do I have a prediction for the future?
Yeah, for the future that's about ready to come out that you had predicted a short time ago. That we'll see the fruits of.
I have one that's just come true. I wrote in the 1980s in my first book that blind people would be able to take a tiny device weighing a few ounces out of their pocket and read all the print as they go through the world. Because we had just introduced a machine that was the size of a washing machine that could do that, the reading machine for the blind. And we did, a couple of months ago, introduce this reading machine in a 4-ounce cell phone that can read in 7 languages and translate from one language to another.
You did?
Yeah.
You have that with you?
No, I don't. I didn't bring it with me.
So you can open up the cell phone and it will translate, it will read and translate into 7 languages.
Right. You can read a French document, have it come out in English or in French. There's about 1,000 guys and gals going around now reading signs on the wall, bank ATM displays, menus, handouts at meetings with the cell phone, which works as a cell phone or a web browser. It's also a GPS system, all with voice output for the blind or dyslexic. Hmm. Displays on the screen for dyslexic individuals what it's reading with synchronized highlighting that helps build their reading skills.
Wow. And how soon can I get one of these, or anybody? Or is it you're keeping this to yourself for those 1,000 people?
No, this is a product. People can go to knfbreader.com and all the information on how to buy one is on there. This is a shipping commercial product.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about solar energy. I've noticed we've covered very closely an explosion in solar thermal power. For example, the state of California has a mandate to get 20% of their energy from renewable sources, and they've turned towards solar energy in great quantity.
Yeah, well, I just got done with this blue ribbon panel that the National Academy of Engineering organized. Larry Page of Google and Greg Venter and a few others and myself were on this to look at this issue of how we can meet our energy needs, particularly in an environmentally friendly way. And there are a number of ideas, but solar is the most exciting because there's so much sunlight around. We actually have 10,000 times more than we need. If we captured one part in 10,000 of the sunlight that falls in the Earth, we could meet 100% of our energy needs. And the solar panels that we've had to date are not efficient or lightweight or inexpensive enough to do that. But there's a new generation of nano-engineered solar panels coming out, and other new ideas like concave mirrors to focus the sunlight onto a small space, and lots of new technologies, particularly fueled by nano-engineering, that are much more efficient and much less expensive. We believed in the National Academy of Engineering report that we wrote and that was endorsed by NAE, stated that we're less than 5 years away from a tipping point where solar energy will be less expensive per watt than coal and oil and other fossil fuels. Of course, if things keep going the way they did today, that'll be even sooner.
Tomorrow, it could be, with $150
And there's an exponential here. We're actually doubling every 2 years the amount of renewable energy, particularly from solar and wind. Ultimately, solar has more potential because there's more of it around. And we're only seven doublings away from meeting all of our energy needs, which is to say it's about 1% today. But people tend to dismiss these phenomena when they're only 1%, saying, well, 1%'s not a big deal. But they miss the exponential. It's like the Genome Project was dismissed as not working out because halfway through this 15-year project, we'd only finished 1% of the genome. And people said, you know, I told you this wasn't going to work. But seven more doublings, which is what happened over the next 7 years in that project, the project got done on time. Same thing with the Internet. It was only connecting 10,000 scientists, and people dismissed it as insignificant in the 80s, but it was doubling every year, and doubling every year is multiplying by 1,000 in 10 years. So 10 years later, as I predicted in my first book, this was a worldwide phenomenon connecting hundreds of millions of people. So you have to look at these exponential phenomena, and information technology tends to move in that exponential progression. When I was at MIT, we all shared one computer. Your cell phone today is a million times smaller, a million times cheaper, and the computing is 1,000 times more powerful. That's a billion-fold increase in price performance since I was a student at MIT, and we'll make another billion-fold increase in the next 25 years.
1-800-989-8255, talking with Ray Kurzweil, author of The Singularity is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology. Let's talk a bit about humans, because can we expect that life expectancy could be not run linearly, but maybe doubling?
Well, there's a very important phenomenon that's happening in health and medicine. I just got back this morning from a MIT board meeting, and we've announced a new department of biological engineering, the first new department at MIT in 39 years. Not even computer science got its own department, because we can now engineer our biology as information processes. And that's a brand new concept that was not possible just a few years ago. We collected the genome in 2003. We have RNA interference, a technique now that can turn genes off. We have new forms of gene therapy that can add new genes. We can turn on and off enzymes. We can simulate biological processes on computers. We can design drugs on computers rather than just find substances that seem to work without an understanding of why they work. So health and medicine has become an information technology. And as such, it's subject to what I call the law of accelerating returns, which is this exponential growth, essentially a doubling every year of its capability, price performance, and capacity. So these technologies, which are in an early stage now, will be 1,000 times more powerful in a decade, a million times more powerful in 20 years. We've been adding linearly to human life expectancy. You know, it was 37 years in 1800, and we've been adding 3 months a year in recent decades. But this will go into high gear now that it's not hit or miss anymore, now that it's a information technology. According to my models, 15 years from now, we'll be adding more than a year to your remaining life expectancy. Now, it's not a guarantee. That's a statistical phenomenon. You could get hit by lightning tomorrow, but it will change the metaphor of the sands of time running out.
But if you're adding more than a year every year, you should be living forever then,
Well,
besides getting hit by a car or something like that. Statistically.
Well, Yeah, as time goes on, life expectancy will move on away from you, and we'll be able to overcome more and more issues. But, you know, life expectancy is statistical, so that won't be a guarantee for all of us. But even baby boomers like myself, I just turned 60, do have the opportunity, if they're aggressive, applying today's knowledge, to still be in good shape when we get to that point 15 years from now. And I'm, you know, I'm working on that myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember you talking about your diet and things like that.
Well, I am aggressive and trying to use today's technology to keep myself healthy. And, you know, I still have a biological body, but, you know, if we go out 10, 15, 20 years, we're going to start augmenting our bodies and brains with this, with our technology, and ultimately merge with it. There are people walking around today who have, for example, computers in their brains, like Parkinson's patients, and this pea-sized computer replaces the biological neurons destroyed by that disease. And just recently, the latest generation allows you to actually download new software to the computer in your brain from outside the patient. That's if you're a Parkinson's patient. And ultimately, we'll be able to send these devices in without surgery through the capillaries of the brain, because we're also shrinking technology at an exponential rate of a factor of 100 per 3D volume per decade. So if you look at what we can do today, multiply its capability by a billion in 25 years, which is what we will do through this continued exponential progression, and shrink these technologies by a factor of 100,000, you get some idea of what will be feasible. But even though most computers in the world today are not inside our bodies and brains, they're in our pockets. You can take out a 4-ounce device and access all of human knowledge with a few keystrokes, virtually all human knowledge. I mean, that's an extension of who we are already, and we're getting more closer to these technologies. When I was a student
at MIT. Ray, I'm going to have to hold that thought, because we have to take a break. We'll come back and pick up right there, okay? Talking with Ray Kurzweil about the future, and he has a lot to say and interesting stuff, so stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with Ray Kurzweil, inventor, futurist, author of many books, including The Singularity Is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology, and we're just getting into that, about humans merging with technology. And it just sort of creeps in. Is nanotechnology going to make this all very possible, Ray?
That's another revolution that's in a very early stage. I'd say biotechnology is actually the next revolution that we'll experience, the ability to really reprogram our biology. So drugs will actually be designed on computers, tested on simulators. They'll be turning on and off our genes. And that's a technology that's beginning to become mature. Nanotechnology is still a little far away, but ultimately that will transform, for example, energy by enabling nano-engineered solar panels. It will also revolutionize health. We'll have, if I were to say someday you'll have blood cell-sized devices in your bloodstream going through your body and keeping you healthy at the cellular level from inside, that you'd think, well, that sounds very futuristic. But there's already several dozen experiments of doing that with the first generation of devices in animals. One scientist cured type 1 diabetes in rats with a blood cell-sized device. It's nano-engineered, has 7-nanometer pores that let out insulin in a controlled fashion. At MIT, they have a blood cell-sized device that can detect cancer cells based on the antigens on their surface and destroy them. And there are a variety of experiments like this in animals, and these will be going into human trials in the years ahead. But I'd say the real nanotechnology revolution is a little bit far away. But if you go out to the 2020s, we will have desktop-sized devices that can fabricate three-dimensional products that will meet your material needs. There are already early harbingers of this. But just as I can email you today a book or a movie or a sound recording, whereas those used to be physical products, now they're just email attachments, in the future I'll be able to email you a blouse or a physical device or food, and you'll be able to just send that email attachment to your
desktop nano replicator, and it will create a three-dimensional object.
Do you think we'll be able to transport people like they do in Star Trek?
Well, that's a ways away. That's not 2020s, but if you got to 2040s or 2050s, we will be mostly non-biological because we're going to be merging with our technology. The non-biological portion of our intelligence is going to grow exponentially. The biological portion is fixed. If you go out to far enough, then we will be mostly non-biological. And we do know that non-biological files we can easily replicate. We do that every day with our computers. We don't have those quick downloading ports on our biological neurons. That's one thing that biological evolution left out. So as we become more non-biological, we will be able to do things like back up our mind file.
Let me go to Mark in San Francisco. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you. I wonder if Mr. Kurzweil studies any of the dangers of future science as well as the positive, because I'd love to be immortal, but I also worry, you know, if I'm non-biological, am I going to respond to things the same way because I won't have, you know, hormones and such, or are there going to be biological warfare that's going to be very dangerous? Do you study any of the downsides?
Well, very much so, and it's a broad topic. I don't think augmenting ourselves with non-biological technology, you know, necessarily makes us less emotional. In fact, it is going to be capturing our emotional intelligence, which will be the heart of the artificial intelligence project. But yes, there are downsides to technology. There have been ever since we had technology, like fire and stone tools. And the specter that exists today is applying biotechnology to be destructive. So you could have a bioterrorist using the same tools that we hope to overcome cancer and heart disease, could use that to reprogram a biological virus to be more deadly, more communicable, or more stealthy. Mm-hmm. And the tools and knowledge to do that are actually more widespread than the tools and knowledge to, for example, build an atomic bomb, yet could actually be more destructive. And I've written extensively about that. Chapter 8 of my latest book, Singularities Near, is called The Deeply Intertwined Promise of GNR, which is genetics, nanotechnology, and robotics. And I've worked with the Army on this issue of biological viruses, setting up a rapid response system. And the good news is we actually have the scientific knowledge to combat that. We can now sequence a virus in a day or two. It took us 5 years to sequence HIV. We can create an RNA interference medication quickly. We can gear up manufacturing. We can test it using new protocols in an emergency. And so I'm on the Army Science Advisory Board, and the Army is responsible for this area. And yes, we do need to invest in rapid response systems, just like we have a rapid response system for software viruses. But these technologies certainly can be abused, and the high-level message is we need to invest in the defenses, have ethical standards for responsible practitioners, and I have been very involved in that issue.
I have a couple of questions here. I'll take this one from Manfer in Second Life and equal questions in on the phone. And they want to know, where have you gone wrong? And your any major erroneous projections or theories that you had that have not passed, come to pass, or not going to happen?
Well, I've just been reviewing some of that in the Age of Intelligent Machines and Age of Spiritual Machines. I mean, some things are a few years off, but I've really tried to avoid the temptation to make projections about specific companies or what, you know, will the next wireless standard be, G3, G4, et cetera, and tried to really base them on what I, you know, believe are pretty inexorable trends in information technology. And in broad strokes, so the descriptions I've made of future periods, for example, the book I wrote in the 1980s, The Age of Intelligent Machines, finished in 87, provides a pretty accurate roadmap to the 90s and this decade that we're now finishing. Age of Spiritual Machines I wrote 10 years ago.
But have you been wrong about certain things?
I can't cite, you know, a major incorrect prediction. There's some things that are off by a few years. Speech recognition, I believe, is going to become ubiquitous when we get more powerful mobile phones that have enough processing power to run high-quality speaker-independent large vocabulary speech recognition, and that's coming early in this decade. I said that that would be ubiquitous by around 2009, 2010. I think it looks like we'll have powerful enough computers, and people will want to do that, but it'll probably be 2011 or 2012. But it's not far off.
Mm-hmm. Do you see any limitations at all? Do you see us, do you see us using up the Earth in the future?
I mean, there are limitations. I talk about, there's only so much computation you can squeeze out of matter and energy. But it turns out to be not very limiting. I mean, ultimately, when we capture the software of human intelligence by reverse engineering our brains and then apply that to computing at the molecular level, we can multiply our intelligence by the end of this century.
But will that make us smart enough not to use up the Earth and have to move off of it?
I don't think we're going to use up the Earth. We actually have lots of resources here, once we develop these methods we've been talking about. I mean, as I mentioned, we have 10,000 times more sunlight than we need. We need the nanotechnology-based solar collectors that can do that efficiently. We have lots of water. Dean Kamen has an exciting technology that can, once it's perfected, really convert that in, very efficiently, very inexpensively. We have lots of material resources once we can reorganize the molecules using nanotechnology. We'll be able to support really any conceivable size biological population, certainly through the rest of this century. I don't see using up resources as a problem if you look at the exponential progression of these technologies we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ray, I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today. And good luck to you.
Yeah, my pleasure, Ira.
And good luck on your book. Ray Kurzweil, inventor, futurist, and author of The Singularity Is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology. He's also the CEO of Kurzweil Technologies. Now, my next guest is he's a kind of guy who, when he's about to step into one of the country's highest security biosecurity labs, a place you'd never find me, he thinks to grab his reporter's notebook and mechanical pencil on the way in, ready to record what he's about to see. And he's been into some really interesting, that's a lack of a better scary word, places. His stories have taken him into labs that are in close contact with one of the deadliest viruses around, into the tops of the world's highest trees, the labs of some of the world's most notable scientists, and the apartment of a Russian mathematician building a supercomputer to crunch the number of pi. The number pi, how many digits can you get it to find some sort of hidden order there? Richard Preston brought us the story of the Ebola virus in the hot zone and smallpox and the demon in the freezer. And now he's put all these new stories together in his book, Panic in Level 4. And it includes a story about cannibals, but in this case, it's people who eat themselves. So, Richard Preston is here, and welcome back to Science Friday.
Hello, Ira.
People, that is the last chapter in your book, close to the last chapter in the book, if I remember.
Yeah, I suppose I wouldn't recommend anybody read that last chapter before eating dinner.
I gave a lunch alert earlier, earlier in the day. What drives you to go to these really dangerous places?
Well, I think it's probably some kind of ridiculous personal obsession. I don't think anybody really writes a book unless they have an obsession about the material. And I love exploring the mysterious tattered margins of science where reporters rarely go and where mysteries remain unsolved. I think one of the things that we don't learn about science in school is that science is really not about facts as much as it is about mystery and about not knowing.
Mm-hmm.
And I love to cover the quest of people in science who try to answer questions that may in fact be unanswerable. And they often put their lives on the line for this. And in order to write about them, I sometimes have to go where they go.
Mm-hmm. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flato, talking with Richard Preston, author of Panic in Level 4, Cannibals, Killer Viruses, and Other Journeys to the Edge of Science. It's also, it's just out. How do you find the story ideas for some of these really interesting places?
I really don't know. I have absolutely no
idea. But that's good. If they're continuing to come, that's a good thing if you don't know that.
Yeah,
you don't have to look for them.
I think like many writers, you know, I have a sort of attic of ideas, and you know, sometimes things fall out of the attic.
Let's talk about some of the unusual stories. Of course, we remember when you talked about the Ebola virus. Didn't you feel your life in jeopardy or putting you really in harm's way at any point in that?
Well, that was a sort of very creepy incident that occurred while I was researching The Hot Zone, the book. Mm-hmm. And I chose not to talk about it in the book because I wanted the book to focus on the people, not on the writer. Mm-hmm. But what happened was that I put a lot of requests in to the Army to let me go into a biosafety level 4 hot zone at Fort Detrick in Maryland, mm-hmm. where they were working with real Ebola and other dangerous viruses. Now, this is a spacesuit laboratory where you put on a full pressurized suit, and then you go through an airlock door into this hot zone. And eventually they relented, and I went in with two younger researchers, a man and a woman. I was told as I was going in, you know, you can bring your notebook and your pencil in, but they will never come out except as a melted lump. And so they gave me a sheet of Teflon to write on to take notes on, and then they gave me a Bic pen when I got into the hot area. It was a hot zone pen that would never leave the hot zone except as a melted lump of plastic. We got in there, and I had put on a spacesuit. The researchers were all using spacesuits that had their names on them that were strung up on a wall in the staging area. Mm-hmm. And I get in there, and I had a spacesuit without a name on it. It was a loner.
And you must have been a little suspicious of those loners.
I am now. And yeah. They were doing research into human blood samples of an individual who had died of an apparent unknown X virus that had Marburg-like characteristics. Marburg is a type of Ebola. Mm-hmm. So the person had died with blood streaming from their orifices. And they were trying to characterize the virus, identify what it might be. And I was looking through a microscope when all of a sudden my spacesuit collapsed around me and lost pressure. And I looked down but couldn't see anything because of my helmet and began feeling around with my gloves and suddenly discovered that I was feeling my bare chest. My spacesuit had fallen wide open, had burst open in the hot zone. This was an old, crummy piece of military hardware that didn't have anybody's name on it. So I stood up and I said to one of the researchers, "Hey, do I have a problem here?" And his face told the story. And he moved across the room very rapidly, and mm-hmm. he pushed my suit together. These spacesuits have a zipper that's like a Ziploc bag. Mm-hmm. It had popped way open. Mm. So he got me patched up, and then I repressurized. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, what I was thinking was, oh, my gosh.
How long do I have?
Stupid idiot. What are you doing in level 4 for a book?
Right, right. 1-800-989-8255, talking with Richard Preston, author of Panic in Level 4. And, of course, Level 4 is the most it's the highest level.
Biosafety Level 4 is the highest level of biosecurity.
It's where those hoods and things that you were talking about.
Right. They use pretty high-tech equipment to try to contain these organisms that, mm-hmm. were they to get out, could do some damage in the human species and also could do some damage to the researchers. Mm-hmm.
Tell me about this search for pi. I mean, you write so well about trying to get pi so high, you know, people trying to find inner meaning in pi. Are these people nuts? I mean, what is this going on?
This is maybe my favorite story of all.
Yeah, you read it.
Two Russian brothers, David and Gregory Chudnovsky, who live in New York City. They claim to be a single mathematician who by chance occupies two human bodies.
Details.
Yes. Gregory, the younger brother, has a wasting disease that keeps him in bed or in a wheelchair most mm-hmm. of the time. So when he walks around, he's often supported by his brother, Gregory. At the time that I first met them, they were building a supercomputer in their apartment out of mail-order parts. The place was just – the entire apartment was occupied by computing equipment, along with Gregory's mother and his wife. They had 26 fans running to cool the computer. and they had a meat thermometer stuck into parts of it. And they said, they explained that if the meat thermometer got to pork, you had to be worried about the
that's
machine.
That's 160. I'm going to stop you right there because now that you set the stage, it's a great story. I don't want to have to interrupt you again. So now we'll get back. We have to take a break. We'll come back and talk lots more with Richard Preston, author of Panic and Level 4. Also, you may know him by the best-selling book, The Hot Zone. We'll hear the rest of that interesting story about the search for pie and take your call. So stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about living sort of reporting on the edge, panic and level four, cannibals, killer viruses, and other journeys to the edge of science. And that is written by Richard Preston, the author of the book. Brief program note before we continue. On Wednesday, here's your opportunity to sit in on a live version of Talk of the Nation. Neil Conan is going to be back at the museum in Washington. And if you're going to be in Washington and you want tickets to join the audience, send an email to tickets@npr.org. And when I rudely interrupted Richard, he was setting us up about these two guys living in an apartment filled with all kinds of computers, looking to solve pi.
Yes, two mathematicians named Gregory and David Chudnovsky.
Is that their real name?
Real names. Oh. Yes. And they're respected, well-known mm-hmm. mathematicians. Gregory Chudnovsky, the younger brother, the one who mostly has to lie in bed, is in fact one of the world's leading designers of supercomputers. And he appears to be able to design them in his head the way Mozart wrote music. At any rate, they were using this homemade supercomputer to compute pi to more than 2 billion decimal places. Mm-hmm. Now, the number pi is the ratio of the diameter of a circle to its own circumference. And if you take the number and you express it in digits, it goes 3.14159 and on and on and on to infinity. Mm-hmm. It never ends. There's a curious problem involving pi here because the digits of pi have no apparent design or order in them. They appear perfectly random ad infinitum. And yet the circle is perhaps the most perfect object known in mathematics. So why should the ratio of the diameter to the circumference be so apparently totally disorganized? Why? This is a problem that I think most mathematicians would say that there is a design or a pattern in pi, but that they can see no conceivable way that any computer or mathematical tool could ever see the order in pi in our universe. But nevertheless, the Chudnovskys were trying, and were they to find a glimpse of an order in pi, it would be like getting a glimpse of the face of God.
And so do they continue to this day?
They have a fairly limited attention span, and so they went 2 billion decimals into pi, and they got tired of looking, and they moved on to other, perhaps more interesting problems.
In fact, quoting from your book, I asked Gregory if an impression I had of mathematicians was true, that they spend a certain amount of time declaring one another's work trivial. And you say, it's true, he admitted, there's actually a reason for this. Because once you know the solution to a problem, it usually is trivial.
Yeah.
So they must have decided that it was already enough with this.
Yes.
Right?
I had a lot of trouble taking notes with these guys.
Yeah.
I take notes longhand. I don't use a tape recorder. And I got D's in math in high school. And I never went on with math in college. And I was listening to these very sophisticated statements about higher mathematics. Well, I found out the way to deal with it was I took careful notes, couldn't understand a word of them, and then took them to another leading mathematician, a certain Herbert Robbins, mm-hmm. who walked me through areas of higher mathematics and essentially taught me what I needed to know.
1-800-989-8255. Before time gets away with us, we have plenty of time. I want to make sure you talk about the case of the cannibalism that was discovered in hospitals. It's very, really fascinating.
This is a genetic disease that is probably one of the grimmest diseases I've ever seen or even heard of. A genetic disease, of course, is a disease that we inherit in our genes.
Mm-hmm.
The syndrome is called the Lesch-Nyhan syndrome after the two doctors who discovered it at the Johns Hopkins Hospital in 1962 when a little boy was brought in. And he had some pretty serious problems. He'd been diagnosed with having cerebral palsy, but that wasn't the problem at all. Mm-hmm. He had been chewing off his extremities.
Literally chewing off.
Off his portions of his fingers. He had bitten off portions of his lips. And he was engaging in very subtle and somewhat terrifying acts of self-destruction, self-sabotage, in which he would do things that would... he would injure himself very purposefully, or he would lash out at people he liked. And I now have spent time with people with the Lesch-Nyhan syndrome, the self-cannibalism disease. And it's true that a Lesch-Nyhan person likes you when he starts taking swings at you.
And the impression I got was that these people don't want to do this. They have no control. They can't stop themselves.
No. When they attack other people, they apologize profusely.
But about eating themselves and the
And
flesh?
They're absolutely terrified of their own self-attacks. They feel as if their hands are not a part of their body, mm-hmm. but are under the control of some demon outside themselves.
Right.
One of them told me that he bites his hands in order to scare them away from his face. This particular guy that I got to know, James Elrod. Had been left alone for a couple of minutes by an attendant. He was in a state hospital, and the attendant was inexperienced. And in just a couple of minutes, James's left hand picked up a fork and used it to cut his nose off.
Wow. And you write that James would frequently warn you about getting too close.
Yeah, he would say danger, danger. He would get this look
in his
eyes.
I might hurt you. Don't get too close.
Yeah. But I found that I really like these people. I got to be friends with them. They live with an almost unbearable disability, and yet they had a kind of nobility and courage about them. They had this capacity to enjoy life that was remarkable. The disease itself is a mystery. It's a really deep, puzzling mystery. It's caused by the alteration of a single letter in the human DNA. So 3.2 billion letters in the human code, 25,000 active genes. And if you change a single letter there, the person in the wrong place, the person develops this striking, spectacular behavioral syndrome, which is governed entirely by the writing in the DNA. The Lesch-Nyhan syndrome is the most striking example of this kind of disease, mm-hmm. where human behavior is altered by a gene. And it is a kind of Rosetta Stone for human behavior. If we could only understand what happens when people chew on themselves or attack themselves this way, we might have insights into lots of mm-hmm. human behavior.
There are not very many pictures or graphs or photos in the book, but you do have a really... stark photo of that patient.
Yeah, I have a very, very stark
photograph. Is
there
a reason you purposely put that in the book?
Well, I got the photograph from Dr. William Nyhan, the discoverer of the disease, who said it would be okay to use it. And it's just chilling. I mean, it's not a photograph you even want to look at before you eat dinner.
Yeah.
But it shows a young boy who was beloved by his caretakers, JJ, originally from New Hampshire. He lived in the laboratory of William Nyhan for several years, and he had with his hands torn out, picked away all of the upper palate in his face, and so he has nothing left in the center of his face. His nose is gone, much of his mouth, and there's just basically a huge hole there. And then he had bitten off his fingers.
Hmm. And you play a major part in this story, and you took them out of the hospital, off-roading in a dry lake bed in California.
Yeah. This was originally an article for The New Yorker, and it was a ridiculously long time to write it. It took me 7 years to write this thing because I had to somehow find a way to connect with the humanity of these people. I couldn't make them into freaks. They're not freaks. And I ended up, it turned out they're real guys, people with this disease, and they love off-roading. So mm-hmm. we went off-roading, and we went out into a lake, and against the advice of a police officer, I drove them out into the middle of a dried lake bed, which turned out to be actually quicksand. We got stuck in the quicksand, and then when I started calling towing companies, I found out nobody would come get us. So I had these two disabled guys in wheelchairs in the middle of a quicksand lake with no way out. And the interesting thing was that the Lesch-Nyhan guys just had a wonderful time, and they were absolutely delighted at what I had done because they saw an example of their own self-destructive behavior in me.
Mm-hmm.
They got a huge kick out of that. There is a little bit of Lesh Nyhan in all of us.
Self-destructive behavior.
Yes, exactly. Self-destructive behavior. We all do things that we can't control, that we regret and wish we could stop. One of the neurologists who studies these people explained it to me this way. He said, you know, there are lots of people in the world who bite their nails and don't like it but can't stop it. And there are other people who bite their cuticles until they bleed. And then many people, when they're nervous, bite their lips. Now imagine that as being a kind of feedback system in the brain. Now turn the volume way, way up until it's screaming loud, and you have a Lesh Nyhan person.
1-800-989-8255, talking with Richard Preston, author of Panic in Level 4. I mean, there's so much to talk about in this book, but are you already on to the next topic? Are you researching new things? Or?
Well, I'm always, playing around with things. And sometimes stories don't go anywhere. You know, I often will do a lot of preliminary interviews, and I'll think, gee, I don't know. or I'll come back to it later. And the Lesh Nyhan story was like that. I just kept coming back to it.
It's a long time. You said 9 years? You
were 7 years to write one stupid magazine article. I couldn't
that's
believe
a
it.
That's a lot of writer's block, or is it just a lot of research?
It wasn't really writer's block. It was sometimes you just have to play a waiting game. It's like fishing. You just have to find your way. This material was so deep and so difficult to handle.
You had to wait for it to click in your head.
Yeah, I had to find a way through the maze.
Yeah, yeah. What's your second favorite story in the book?
It may be the story about the mathematicians.
Yeah.
I come back to them.
You do.
They moved on from pi. Mm-hmm. And some years ago, at the Cloisters Museum, the medieval museum in New York City, they have the seven unicorn tapestries, which are some of the most beautiful works of art from the Middle Ages. They display the Hunt of the Unicorn. They were made around 1500 in northern France or Holland. And they took them down from the walls. These tapestries are worth something like $1 billion. Nobody knows what they're worth, really. Mm-hmm. They took the backs off, and they found out that the backs of the tapestries were radiant color that hadn't seen the light of day in centuries, whereas the fronts of the tapestries had faded markedly. So they decided to photograph them. They made these digital images at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, but the camera wasn't large enough to take in an entire tapestry, so they had a kind of mosaic of photographs. And then they found that they couldn't knit the mosaic together into a digital image, and the problem was that the tapestries, when they had been removed from the wall, were like something alive, and they had moved and breathed while they were being photographed. They had changed their shape, even in three dimensions.
Wow.
And so it happens that the Chudnovsky brothers got involved with this, and they built a new supercomputer. They call this one the Home Depot machine because it has lots of parts from Home Depot. And doing this exceedingly sophisticated work with number theory, they managed to somehow or other make the largest digital image of any object that's ever been made, the unicorn tapestries.
Wow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow talking with Richard Preston, author of Panic in Level 4. We just have a couple more minutes, but I want to talk about the trees of North America have been hit with all sorts of Ebolas of their own. I thought that was really surprising.
Yeah. It was very surprising to me. Lately, one of my previous book was about climbing in redwood trees in California.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned how to climb these super tall trees. And while I was doing this, I heard that an ancient rainforest in the east was threatened by a disease, an invading disease. Now, who even knew that there are rainforests in the east? This is in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park.
Right? I knew about the Olympic Peninsula, but I didn't know about
in the east. I didn't even know about this.
Sure.
And the tree is the eastern hemlock tree, which is now its very existence as a species is being threatened by an alien invader, a little insect that is just wiping these trees out, turning these tracts of virgin rainforest into gray skeletons like dead coral reefs. So I ended up climbing in these trees and looking around and seeing and trying to learn what was happening. And horrifyingly, the bigger picture is that what's happening to the trees of North America, not just the hemlocks, but many other species, the American elm, the chestnut, many others, is exactly the same thing that's happening to the human species with the emergence of new infectious diseases. With global climate change and with the movement of human populations around the planet, ecosystems are getting homogenized, and invasive microorganisms and parasites are moving into new hosts. So that what we're seeing with, say, the outbreak of, you know, Ebola virus, SARS, all these new emerging infectious diseases is just a very small corner of a larger kind of global size disturbance of ecosystems.
Yeah, we see invasive species, beetles coming from China, other places, just chewing up the forests.
Absolutely, yeah. The American elm is by no means the only one. There are a number of species of ash trees in America, and they're all thoroughly endangered by a little invading beetle that's coming from Asia.
Is that the Asian longhorned beetle?
There's one. That's one. And this is the Asian, what is it called, the emerald borer. And, among other things, the Major League Baseball bat may be doomed because it's made of ash wood.
Oh, well, they're going to these maples that splatter and shatter that I'm not crazy about. So I'm not here. I love the old ones, so I'm not happy to hear about that. This is a fascinating book, and it's interesting reading. And what I like about it is you can read it in small chunks. You have a lot of different chapters, a lot of different parts in there. And I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Good to be with you.
And we'll look forward to wherever that creative bing goes off in your head, right? That'll take you to the most dangerous place and we'll know you've arrived. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. We're talking with Richard Preston, author of Panic in Level 4, Cannibals, Killer Viruses, Other Journeys to the Edge of Science. I really highly recommend it. Thanks again, Richard, for being with us today. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today from NPR librarian Kim Oleski, engineer Glenn Alexander in Boston. And if you have comments or questions, you can write to us the old classic way. Science Friday, 4 West 43rd Street, room 306, New York, New York, 10036. Or if you want to do the cyber way, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. We're podcasting and blogging and putting up new videos and got about two or three of them up there today. And looking for your videos. If you have some interesting videos and stuff that you work on in science or any kind of related field, we'd love to see them. And we'll tweak them a little bit, put them back on our website, and let everybody share them. Also, we have still the Science Friday Skits Connection, old editions back there that you might use them for teaching science. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flato in New York.